You could beep me, call me, email me, stall me, download me, text me, IM me, Twitter me, friend me, ring me, hit me, conference me, blast me, post me, or you could just drop me a line. Do not disturb? What does that mean? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 30th, and we're taking a look at the consequences of our electronically distracted world. Also, a debate over the sociology of crime statistics, another term as president for Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, the long-term plan in Iraq for the U.S. military, and it's a WALL-E world this morning, the little robot movie that could, did, that and all the news. African Union monitors have declared Friday's re-election of Zimbabwe's president, Mugabe, undemocratic, just as a summit of the continent's leaders got underway in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. A union statement quotes an unnamed AU official who detailed the ways they say the election violated standards.
There was violence in the run-up to the elections. The fear of violence deterred popular participation in the electoral process. There was no equitable access to the public media.
African leaders are expected to push for a power-sharing agreement between President Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. The head of a helicopter company involved in the deadly Arizona collision says it would be rare for two medical helicopters to be trying to land at a hospital at the same time. Six people died and a seventh person was critically hurt when two choppers collided in midair near Flagstaff Medical Center. Two patients are among the dead.
A nearly 700-page study released by the Army says in the euphoria of early 2003, U.S.-based commanders prematurely believed goals in Iraq were reached. The report calls the civilian and military planning for a post-Saddam Iraq inadequate. In Pakistan, pro-Taliban militants have threatened to retaliate after Pakistani troops destroyed some of its bases near the Afghan border. Pakistan's new government appears to be shifting from negotiation to military action as the Taliban threatens Peshawar, a Pakistani city of 3 million people.
A U.S. ship carrying 37,000 tons of wheat has arrived in North Korea. It's the first installment of 500,000 tons in promised U.S. aid. That's after the communist nation released details of its nuclear weapons program last week. Firefighters in Northern California are still battling more than 1,000 wildfires in the area. Forecasters say dangerous conditions are unlikely to relent anytime soon. 9 in 10 people in a new Associated Press Yahoo News poll expect the ballooning cost to squeeze them financially over the next 6 months. Nearly half think that hardship will be serious.
Consumer confidence, at a low. Oil has topped $142 a barrel in European trading. The S&P begins trading at 1278. We're talking about distractions today. How distracted are you, and how do you feel about it? Here's a couple of responses.
Talk about being distracted. I'm distracted just by being at work.
This is Chris from Brooklyn, New York. Talking to the theater manager, he's nice enough to give us a tour. But apparently a big problem, people using their cell phones during the film, texting or calling, and so he's constantly bringing people out, giving them an ultimatum, you know, turn it off or take off. And a lot of times, I guess, people just end up leaving.
How does our electronic world distract you or make you feel like a super multitasker? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE before I get distracted.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Here's a bit of disturbing news. There's no particular update or headline in the so-called war on terror this morning. Perhaps that is the big news. How little Osama bin Laden is in the headlines these days, and how little the fight to find him makes it into the news. But this morning, the New York Times publishes an extraordinary chronicle of the war on terror, particularly the war against al-Qaeda. Reporter Mark Mazzetti joins us. His reporting work documents the attacks and the frustrating attempts to find and capture Osama bin Laden and to degrade al-Qaeda. Mark Mazzetti, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Where are we in the fight for bin Laden? Let's just start with that. What you know, where do we stand at this moment, and what capabilities do we think that we have?
Well, most intelligence officials in the United States agree that Al-Qaeda is, if not as strong as they were on September 10th, 2001, certainly have relocated their base of operations into the tribal areas. There are a band of training camps in the tribal areas from which American officials believe that Al-Qaeda is currently plotting attacks against Western targets, even the United States.
Let's unpack the details of that a little bit. Now, it's long been believed that Osama bin Laden was operating, or his whereabouts personally were inside Pakistan, or at least in the northwest frontier border provinces that are so inaccessible to U.S. officials. You're now beginning to report that a fairly large infrastructure exists wholly inside Pakistan, and what does that consist of?
Well, it consists of not only training camps, but in a way, an intricate communication network allowing senior officials to communicate with each other in sometimes very archaic ways, and at the same time elude any kind of detection from Western intelligence, spy satellites, that type of thing. And what we tried to do in the story was to sort of examine how we got to this position, how nearly here we are 7 years after September 11th, Al-Qaeda got to back to this position of strength. What happened in Washington? What happened in Islamabad? And kind of what went wrong along the way?
Of course, many would argue that Al-Qaeda's ability to train is probably not as good as it used to be, since they can't train outside. The facilities that you're talking about in your piece are roofed over, are covered over. Whatever training takes place has to take place outside of the surveillance of U.S. satellites. So there must be some degradation here.
And there have been a number of dozens of strikes, these predator strikes with that the CIA runs with these drone airplanes that strike at fairly senior Al-Qaeda officials. So it does, these strikes keep them on the run, they keep them on their toes, and these are some of the successes that the Bush administration cites. At the same time, another concern is that these predator strikes are only kind of create more problems. They're remote controlled, you end up killing the person who you would rather capture to gain intelligence from, and that person might have led you to bin Laden or some of his senior deputies.
And you complicate relations between the U.S. and Pakistan with some of these raids. Describe, first of all, what the state of that relationship is and how it keeps us from acting inside Pakistan. And perhaps the most disturbing thing about your piece of all is the interagency squabbles that continue inside the Bush administration and the Pentagon that prevents the U.S. military from taking action.
Yeah, and this is one of the interesting things. I mean, there's a passionate debate on both sides about how much the United States can and should do in Pakistan, how much our relationship with the Pakistanis will bear, and whether there would be any value in having small teams of American special operations troops who believe they'd have decent intelligence to launch strikes. How beneficial would it be to go into the tribal areas and launch these strikes? Or what if something went wrong? If a helicopter got shot down, if American troops were killed in Pakistan, it could be a kind of a Black Hawk Down scenario. And so the people who argue against these raids say, on a cost-benefit analysis, the costs are just way too large.
But you say that there are special operations teams ready to go and that they've consistently been held back.
Well, there have been there's a great amount of frustration at the Pentagon and in the special operations community, who believe they look at the intelligence reports and they say they believe they could do more. They believe that they train for these types of missions to capture or kill senior people, and that they would be able to do it without the repercussions that some in the administration worry about. Late last year, as we say in our story, the administration actually took a step of drafting a new plan to make it easier for the Pentagon to do these types of operations. But it's been more than 6 months, and nothing has been approved, and sort of the level of bitterness has only increased.
And how would you describe those tensions between Pakistan and the United States, and then Pakistan and the Northwest Province leaders in moving forward? And is there some way out?
Well, right now, it seems very much in a holding pattern. I mean, the Bush administration, in a way, got lucky after the September 11th attacks in having an alliance with President Musharraf of Pakistan. But as we report in our story, that became, in some ways, a crutch where we relied so much on Musharraf, and we trusted him to take action in the tribal areas. And in many cases, he didn't. He had advisors who never really saw the threat that the United States saw. Now, in the current situation with the new government, it's even harder because it's a democratically elected government. They're trying to get on their feet. And rightfully, the United States is concerned about destabilizing this government.
Higher risks in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Mark Mazzetti, a reporter for The New York Times, his extraordinary piece chronicling the fight against al-Qaeda appears in this morning's New York Times. Adora?
Today, a gathering of African Union leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and attending is Robert Mugabe, who has laid claim to his sixth term as president of Zimbabwe, winning an overwhelming 85% in a runoff vote. But many world leaders have called the vote a sham marked by violent oppression of the opposition. The BBC's Liz Blunt joins us from the summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Thanks for joining us, Liz.
Hello, good morning.
Mugabe arrived a few hours ago. How has he been received?
Well, he has been received. He's been allowed in. He has taken the seat, the front row seat on the Zimbabwe desk. So he is there as Zimbabwe's head of state and government. The press are not allowed into the hall. We can only see what we saw on the screens. We had one shot of him sitting there, very impassive. And he had to listen to not direct criticism, but he had to listen to some sort of indirect criticism. I mean, for instance, the chairman of the African Union, the president of Tanzania, Jakaya Kikwete, he rather pointedly congratulated the people of Zimbabwe on their conduct and commiserated with them in their misfortunes. Now, that's a very indirect way of saying it, but he certainly wasn't congratulating President Mugabe on getting re-elected.
Now, many African Union members have become increasingly critical. Kenya's president has called for the African Union to deploy troops, and the prime minister of Ethiopia acknowledged the crisis, saying this.
I don't think either of the parties alone are capable of resolving the deep-seated problems of Zimbabwe and the extraordinary polarization within Zimbabwe society. So we need to find a negotiated way out of this problem.
Liz, this has clearly been at the top of the agenda for many African leaders. Why is it not then on the official agenda of this summit?
Well, that's the way the summit works. I mean, you very often come to these and the thing that everybody is thinking about is not actually there. The agenda of the summit, I mean, things like this usually come under peace and security matters. There is a Peace and Security Council of the African Union, just like the Security Council of the UN. And matters have to be formally raised with that. Up till now, Zimbabwe has not been raised. They've talked about, they deal with Somalia, with Sudan, with Chad, with the DR Congo, but nobody has actually officially raised it with the Peace and Security Council. That has now changed. Last night, the Peace and Security Council met. It met at heads of state level, and they did talk about Zimbabwe. One of the members must have put it on the table. So that is a step forward. When it comes to peace and security matters, then they can talk about it.
What kinds of things could the African Union potentially do? Would they deploy troops to Zimbabwe?
They could. The Peace and Security Council can send peacekeeping forces. They have in the past actually excluded a country. They excluded Togo from the organization when the young son of the president, when the president died, he took over from his father and was sworn in immediately as head of state. That was absolutely not acceptable. And Togo was not allowed back in until he'd been through at least some kind of electoral process. But they're not going to do that. What they're actually going to do, and I think Mr. Meles hinted at this, is to try and persuade the two of them to come together and form some kind of unity government. There's a lot of talk here about working together for the sake of the country, putting aside individual differences.
Liz Blunt from the BBC World Service reporting for us from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Thank you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253. Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday and it's June 30th, and we're wondering, how distracted are you in this age of all kinds of electronic innovation? Your Blackberries, your cell phones, your iPhones, and podcasts and videocasts. We all have so much going on. Here's what one of you told us.
Good morning. My name is Mary Leggio. I'm calling from New York City. I'm a sales rep. There isn't a meeting that I'm sitting in with colleagues, customers, in which my mind is drawn elsewhere by technology, by I'm just used to it happening. And when I come back to the present, I don't know what I've missed. And I'm embarrassed to utter it, because how stupid will I look?
How stupid will she look? Well, how stupid do you look sometimes, or do you feel when you're very distracted? We want to hear your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Author Maggie Jackson, well, she's been investigating exactly how distracted we are, and you say we're really losing focus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a culture of split focus, continuous partial attention, and we're beginning to see the costs. The average knowledge worker switches task every 3 minutes. And once interrupted, it takes 25 minutes to return to what they're originally doing. A third of workers...
Who's going to read your book? There's no chance anyone will ever read
your
book.
They'll skim it, maybe, John. but the sense of uneasiness that I see all around, I mean, a third of workers say they have no time to reflect on what they do. And kids, you know, there's a new national test, a kind of SAT of information skills, and half of college students can't judge the objectivity of a site. So we're mistaking technological savvy with sense-making, and the cost to not only our thinking and our innovation economy, but also our relationships are really mounting.
So we're talking about a runaway train. Maggie Jackson is the author of Distracted, The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. What is that coming dark age you speak of?
Well, a dark age is not necessarily all negative. You know, different dark ages throughout history have often been highly technological ages. In the medieval times, there was the invention of the windmill, the stirrup, etc. And so we are creating a dark age of our own definition. We're skimming on the surface of life. We're not going deeply in thought or in relationships. And we're really beginning to see this sort of unease. People can't keep their head above water.
Well, what worries you most about what we won't be able to do if this attention deficit disorder problem persists? I mean, what experiences will we leave behind?
Well, how can we, in an innovation economy, innovate and create when we have no time to think? How can we progress? What I think we might be missing is the key to creating a high-tech but caring and progressive society. And for instance, what will we be missing? Maybe we'll be missing, you know, what will we do when we can't remember what it was like to have a deep conversation, to wrestle with a text, to problem solve, to stop and think? And we need to be role models of attention, because attention and there are three different types of attention: focus, awareness, and higher order executive kind of decision making. Those are all key to being a human being. And we need to role model attention for our kids, or these skills will actually be lost.
But hasn't that always been the case as technology has evolved over time? What makes it so different today than, say, when the radio or the television or the typewriter or any of the in other innovations that have occurred over the decades and over the centuries?
Right. Well, the climate of distraction that we are wrestling with today really has built up over centuries. And that's one reason we're at a kind of tipping point. We're at a culmination of split focus and hypermobility and even virtuality. There's a book, 1879 novel, Wired Love, about virtual love between telegraph operators. So we've been dealing with this for quite a while. But
that had a happy ending, that book, though.
They proposed in Morse code. So. I couldn't read it, actually.
It's a very happy ending.
Yeah, there's an ending. But we've been dealing with this for a very, very long time. But we need to use our gadgets wisely, and we need to sort of take the bull by the horns and understand how to deal with these new experiences of time and space.
Isn't there a flip side, though, that perhaps some of these electronics actually help us focus by dispatching with things very quickly so you can get on to the next thing? In other words, letters would take hours to write and days to get to the person they were intended for. Today, someone has a question, you answer the question, you send it right away on email, and you go on to the next thing.
Which is great. I mean, we're on connectivity on steroids. That's phenomenal. That's sort of communications riches. And same with instant access to information. But when we lose the ability or the will to go deeply within the information, we're creating a new form of ignorance.
But there's a kind of macho associated with multitasking. Here, this guy, Jose, on our website says, I've been web browsing, paying bills on Facebook and MySpace, doing my morning push-ups and sit-ups throughout your show. On the way to work, I will listen to my iPod while I read. Don't worry, I'm a pro, he says. If I had to choose only one thing to do at a time, it would probably be bouncing off the walls.
Right. Well, we can't become monks. I'm not going to go, you know, live in a convent. I don't want to give up my technology, but I do think we can't subsist on a diet of snippets and glimpses, or we're in trouble.
What if
diet
we discover
of snippets and glimpses? We're going to ask you to hold on with us, Maggie Jackson, journalist and author of Distracted: The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. But right now, we're going to get the latest headlines from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Hello there. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, and oil prices are above $143 a barrel in Europe today and nearing a record high. More than 1,000 wildfires are still burning in Northern California, and local residents are growing increasingly concerned about their air quality. Iraqi police say that a suicide attacker has detonated a bomb at a local council office west of Baghdad, killing at least 12 people. Those killed are reported to include the head of the local tribal council. The incident comes days before the province where the attack took place is expected to be transferred by the Americans to Iraqi control. In South Korea, more than 100 riot police and several hundred protesters are nursing injuries after a weekend of violent protests against the importing of US beef. Last week, South Korea started processing the first batch of U.S. beef to enter the country under new quarantine rules designed to allay Korean fears of mad cow disease. Now, some people say that life is priceless. For Australian Ian Usher, his life is worth $384,000, and that's the price he sold his life yesterday, auctioning it off on eBay. He says he just wants to leave everything behind after a very painful divorce.
Now I'm selling everything that I've got. It's my house and all its contents, my car, my motorbike, my jet ski, spa, projector, everything really, my whole lifestyle.
Oh, sad story. That's Ian Usher. The undisclosed new owner of his life will get an introduction to his friends and a two-week trial as a rug salesman. That was Ian Usher's former job.
Thank you very much, Femi.
Oh, you're welcome.
I have a question for you, Maggie. What distracts you, quickly?
Well, I'm more a person who's a daydreamer, so I'm internally distracted. And that's called zoning out. That's
nothing to do with technology.
There's a whole new study of, you know, called zoning out. And sometimes it's creative, but you can be abducted by your own mind.
You're a columnist for the Boston Globe, too. There's a distraction. There's an attention deficit disorder. Right,
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Thanks, Maggie.
Maggie Jackson, author of Distracted: The Erosion of Attention and the Coming Dark Age. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 30th, and oil prices have hit another record, yet another record, at $143. $1 a barrel. So we'll continue to follow that story. And as the housing and job market struggles along with the skyrocketing oil prices, ever more people will be searching for affordable housing, especially the poor. But what will they do? Many will turn to the government for help. A controversial article in the Atlantic Monthly magazine says one housing policy, one federal housing policy meant to help, might actually be creating more violent neighborhoods. Hannah Rosen, author of the article American Murder Mystery, joins us now, as does Xavier D'Souza Briggs, a professor of urban studies at MIT. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hannah, let's start with you. What conclusions did you come to about public housing and crime in Memphis?
The conclusion I came to is that the very noble effort of knocking down the housing projects and deconcentrating poverty that was going on through the 90s actually had these unintended consequences of creating a kind of ring around many American cities of sort of more high-crime neighborhoods, that people had been far away from the social services they once had, and that they were dispersed sort of without any support system. And so there was a lot of new crime patterns that police had a hard time dealing with. And I was particularly looking at Memphis, where the connections were drawn by two academic researchers there.
And Xavier, do you think that the conclusions in her article are fair? It certainly kicked off a lively debate.
It has done that, and I think the debate is a healthy one, but the article really doesn't provide us the evidence to draw the conclusion, as Ms. Rosen says, that it was housing policy that produced these consequences. It is possible, but to title the article American Murder Mystery and offer this up as an explanation for the spike in crime rates, the evidence is just not there yet, and this is what the researchers themselves, because I've consulted with them, also agree.
And Hannah, how do you respond to that? Because you've said that you do believe that there is more research to do on federal housing policy.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you read the story very closely, it's very careful to say exactly what conclusions I can and can't draw based on the evidence I have. I'm not an academic researcher. I can only say that I walked into this situation. You know, I started from the ground down trying to figure out sort of why does Memphis have the highest murder rate in America, the highest violent crime rate, and then kind of worked up from there and came upon these researchers. And, you know, they were all very careful in saying, you know, we can only prove this so far. There's a lot more research that needs to be done. And there's a couple of other people who have done that explicitly. In the case of Memphis, there happen to be two people, one a housing expert and one police expert, and they both have sort of unusual access to statistics, meaning daily arrest records in the case of the police expert and housing records in the case of the woman who does housing policy, and they happen to be married. So they sort of overlaid their maps and saw kind of an unusually perfect match from where Section 8 residents had moved and where the new crime hotspots are. But they would be the first people to agree that there's a huge amount of causal research to be done. They can only say, okay, look, here's the new pattern. It's pretty obvious when you look at the maps, so somebody do the research. It's more like a cry for help that they're doing, like trying to get people to admit this is very hard to admit. It was a great anti-poverty program. It was based on a lot of research. Most people agreed that concentrated poverty was a terrible thing, and yet here we are living with the unintended consequences, so what do we do about them? So that was their interest in trying to get the word out.
Xavier, could you give us a little bit of background on what the federal housing program proposes to do, and whether or not you think it's been successful in some places and not so successful in others?
Sure. Well, there are a host of different policies. One demolished public housing developments when it was found to be too expensive to continue operating them or to repair them. That happened in the mid-90s, and the Republican Congress pushed that for the most part. Another tried to redevelop public housing into mixed-income housing. It's called Hope 6, and it's won various design awards and innovation awards. And a number of families, quite a few families, as Ms. Rosen points out, got a voucher and moved out of their public housing building and did not move back in. There wasn't enough room for them, or in some cases, they didn't want to move back in. And so there are a host of sort of different policies at work, a number of them in Memphis, but it was mainly market forces, not low-income housing policy, that deconcentrated poverty in the 1990s. I mean, housing policy was a drop in the bucket given the scale of what went on. I think the real danger here is looking at some things that are happening at the same time, and Ms. Rosen does acknowledge this in her piece, that voucher holders, for example, who use these rental vouchers, have often in other cities moved to neighborhoods that were vulnerable or they were in decline already. We absolutely should be thinking about housing policy alongside law enforcement, alongside supportive services, and too little attention was paid to that. But the concern, of course, is that you make a kind of guilt by association or guilty by association argument, and there are already so many stereotypes of the people in these programs in the sense that they're failed programs, and you don't stir up the debate you actually want to see. You invite people to bash housing policy itself.
And Hannah, how would you respond to that? Because that has been one of the criticisms, that essentially you took one slice of some of the issues involved in the rising crime rates and sort of ignored others or didn't pay equal amount of attention to economic issues, to educational programs, to economic shifts, and so on, factors that are often associated with rising crime rates.
Well, two things. One, I will say I'm extremely self-conscious of what this debate can lead to, and I, you know, again, I tried to hedge it very carefully. Like, there is, and I've gotten some of that feedback, believe me, on my email and in other places, you know, why do we let the poor into our neighborhoods? I mean, that's exactly what you want to avoid, because the last thing you want is for people to say, okay, no more money, no more attention paid to housing policy, forget it, because really what you do need is sort of a lot of support services and people to try and pay a little bit more attention. It's sort of like welfare reform, you know, you have to admit that you need more money and more services and sort of more attention and more research, not none, and not to give it up. And I have to say, I do say in the story that this part of the whole picture, I mean, gentrification, you know, was happening, you know, the inner cities were changing, lots of cities like New York, you know, where we're talking about now was very expensive. So, you know, the forces that drove people out of New York were not just federal housing policy, but I can't say federal housing policy made it better. It basically sort of, you know, just rode on that wave and knocked down the housing projects, and then sort of people got scattered. And so you know, it's surely not the only factor that increased crime. I'm the first to admit that. That can't possibly be true. We're not talking about enough people. We're not talking about enough people coming out of the housing projects. But I don't think it helped very much. And I have to say with Hope 6, and I will admit I'm a newbie to housing policy. I started looking into crime. That's something I know a little bit more about. And so the housing part came to me secondary. Hope 6 was a big heartbreak for me. I mean, hardly anybody got back into the Hope 6 projects, the people who had left the housing projects. It's a tiny percentage. It's certainly not a third, you know, the way one thinks when one thinks of mixed-income housing. Mm-hmm. In Memphis, it's something like, you know, 4% of people who leave the housing projects get back into the Hope 6 projects. So the buildings are beautiful, and the downtown looks fabulous, and it's cleaned up, and it's not a high-crime place anymore. But that, you know, as one researcher told me, you know, if you think of Hope 6 as a success, are we talking about the buildings or the people?
Right. And Ahana, let me just stop you right there. So I just want to get Xavier in here very, very quickly. You have about 20 seconds. It has worked in some places, right?
Yeah, it has worked terrifically well in some places. But the issue that Hannah mentioned, if I can go with first names, is a real one across the country, sort of who is being served by it. But the idea was we couldn't continue to operate public housing the way we did in many communities. And in D.C. and Atlanta and other places, there have been fantastic Hope 6 redevelopments.
So more to come on this story. Hannah Rosen, writer for the Atlantic Monthly, and Xavier D'Souza Briggs, professor of urban planning at MIT. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
Well, Disney Pixar's done it again. Their latest film, WALL-E, is set 700 years in the future. It's about a lonely little robot whose job is to clean up our trashed planet Earth. The movie took in $62.5 million over the weekend. Apparently, a robot love story about cleaning up big messes has struck a chord. And on the line with us are two people who can really relate to this story, and they are both named WALL-E. WALL-E Norbury and WALL-E Wu, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. This is WALL-E Wu.
I gather hanging out in a place where people don't live, where there's a giant, enormous mess, and having to clean it up kind of all by yourself is something that you can really relate to. WALL-E Norbury, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's an ongoing thing.
You're a landfill attendant at Hartfield Landfill in British Columbia, correct?
That's correct. Actually, Heartland.
Heartland, great. And WALL-E Wu, you're a brownfield coordinator for the EPA Region 9 in Central California?
Yeah, in San Francisco.
San Francisco. So both of you went and saw WALL-E over the weekend. And WALL-E Norbury, let me begin with you. As a landfill attendant, how did you feel about the little robot?
Well, he was quite an efficient little guy, that's for sure. He was definitely on top of recycling, which is a good thing.
And did you like the movie?
Oh, I thought it was very interesting. It had very different directions and kept you focused and wondering what was going on next. But, yeah, it was a good movie.
a supreme sort of heroic story for a landfill attendant left on planet Earth to clean up the big mess we've all made?
Oh, yeah. He was poor guy. He was lonely. There's no doubt about that. And I guess when you meet the prettiest-looking robot around, I guess it was probably a fun thing.
It's kind of a relationship movie, as we said last week. Wally Wu, your review of Wally for us.
I thought it was an extremely entertaining movie on several levels, besides being probably the best animation movie that Pixar has given. You know, it contains a good storyline, you know, containing romance and music, and also elements of E.T. and 2001 Space Odyssey. But beyond that, from an environmental standpoint, it shows the landfill, which, you know, in brownfields, that's one of the types of brownfields that we have to work with to try and clean up and redevelop.
Wally, is there a lot of romance there in the brownfield, in the landfill, in your experience as a brownfield coordinator?
Well, not necessarily in the brownfields, but, you know, romance is everywhere, as you know, folks that are working on trying to redevelop and clean up brownfields. So
for both of you guys, that's like two sort of filthy thumbs up from Wally Norbury and Wally Wu, correct?
Oh, definitely.
For sure. Sure.
Well, guys, thanks for joining us, and, you know, try to keep it clean out there in British Columbia.
Oh, we will. That's where our the air's the freshest and the mountains are the whitest.
All right. Wally Norbury is landfill attendant at Heartland Landfill and Recycling Center in British Columbia. And Wally Wu, same to you, okay?
Yes, you're welcome. Bye-bye now.
Wally Wu is the brownfield coordinator for EPA Region 9 in San Francisco. Wally is huge with the recyclers, the waste dump managers, and landfill engineers. You heard it here on The Takeaway, and made at least $62 million off of everyone else.
And there's no dialogue, from what I understand, or barely any.
Yeah, it's what's so interesting for international sales, and some people have described it as Chaplin-esque. I think that's great.
You going to go?
Oh, I have to go. I have four kids. I must go.
Okay.
I'll be arrested if I don't go.
Okay, well, we can't wait to hear your review, John.
Or not.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have the latest headlines coming your way from Femi. Okay, Femi?
Hello there. 12 minutes to the hour. Police are investigating two large explosions heard near the Pakistani capital on Monday as the government was engaged in a military operation against militants in its northwestern tribal regions. The Screen Actors Guild says it isn't talking about a strike quite yet. Today is the deadline for a new labour contract with Hollywood producers. And North Korea is letting a record number of World Food Programme aid workers into the country to give out food aid. And now to some news in more detail. The newly elected president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, is in Egypt for an African Union summit. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to the BBC's Liz Blunt, who's covering the meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, and described the reception that Mr. Mugabe is getting.
The chairman of the African Union, the president of Tanzania, Jakaya Kikwete, he rather pointedly congratulated the people of Zimbabwe on their conduct and commiserated with them in their misfortunes. Now, that's a very indirect way of saying it, but he certainly wasn't congratulating President Mugabe on getting re-elected.
African leaders are expected to urge President Mugabe to reach a power-sharing agreement with the opposition. Starting tomorrow, physicians who treat Medicare patients will be absorbing a 10% cut in fees because of a congressional formula that's usually blocked by Congress but hasn't been yet. But before seniors head to voting booths in November, lawmakers are expected to reverse the cut. Now, what could possibly be the link between Bette Midler?
You are the wind beneath my wings.
And athlete Tyson Gay. He actually ran like the wind, and he clocked up a world record 100-meter run yesterday. Now, the only thing is that Gay's time will not be counted as a record because the wind was so strong, so it breaks all the regulations.
And he was running against Bette Midler?
No, he wasn't.
On the track?
I was just trying to think of a windy piece of music tasteless.
Well done.
Flatulent. You can do better, Mr. Hockenberry.
No, I'm Mr. Cleverington. Cleverington, remember?
We've used that once.
Name, yes.
You're too clever by half. Tyson Gay ran the 100 metres in 9.8 seconds, which qualifies him for the Beijing Olympics. So by the time I finish this news story, he would have already have won.
That's right.
100 metres.
That's right. Twice.
Yes.
Twice.
You saying that I'm long-winded?
No. Right. No, he's fast. Thank you, Fanny. He's very fast.
You're very welcome.
So in Iraq, you may or may not know, the mandate that allows the U.S. officially to stay in Iraq, according to international law, and actually justifies our presence, it runs out at the end of the year. And the renegotiation of that U.N. mandate is an opportunity to look at what are the long-term U.S. intentions in Iraq, as well as the demands of the Iraqi government to express its sovereignty and to spend its own oil wealth. As the negotiations go on, we've decided to ask people from various sides of this question what they believe the long-term long game intentions of the United States are in Iraq. And joining us with our latest conversation is Paul Hughes, a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute for Peace. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
You know, the question, what is the U.S. long game in Iraq, is complicated this weekend by the release of a U.S. Army 700-page report, really critical about the strategic sort of vision of even going into Iraq in the first place. First of all, how does this Army report complicate the negotiations? And where do you think we stand right now in assessing what the U.S. long game is in Iraq?
Well, I don't think that the Army report really complicates what's ongoing today in terms of negotiations. After all, it is a history of the post-conflict stabilization effort, or the lack of it, at the end of the fall of Baghdad back in April of 2003. What I have read of the report so far, and it's just been a little bit, certainly comports with my experiences there on the ground in 2003. But for the long-term position of the United States, it's going to have little impact. The Iraqis clearly know we screwed things up, and their attitude is basically, okay, get over it. Now let's fix things.
Let's talk quickly mm-hmm. about what you think moving forward the U.S. presence in Iraq is going to look like, say, 5-10 years from now. Is it going to look like Okinawa? Is it going to look like Germany? Is it going to look like the DMZ in on the Korean border?
Well, no, it's not going to look like any one of those. Iraq is a very unique case. And what I suspect it's probably going to see is a very heavy training presence. We'll probably have perhaps 30 or 40,000 troops involved with doing training of the Iraqi army. The Minister of Defense has told me that it's going to take until 2018 before his army, his military, will be prepared to defend Iraq against a foreign invasion. And it, as you know, Iraq's in a very rough neighborhood. You've got Turkey to the north and Iran to the east, both of whom have a track record of going into Iraq when they feel like it. So it's going to take a while to defend Iraq or to prepare Iraq for its defense, and that's what the military, our U.S. military, will primarily be involved with. I think you're going to see a reduction in the number of combat troops over the next few years, though.
In your view, the major sticking point between the U.S. and Iraq in the negotiations?
It's going to be the issue of sovereignty and whether the Iraqi government has the authority to control U.S. activities, not just the military, which can be handled just as we've handled it elsewhere around the world, but more importantly, with these private security companies. That absolutely drives the Iraqis nuts when you have a private security company out there shooting people and then not being held accountable for it.
Finally, let me ask you this, Paul Hughes. You are a Army colonel and have certainly spent a lot of time not only in the military but dealing with the people of Iraq. What specifically do you think can be done to get over some of these obstacles and fixing the mistakes that have been made?
Well, there are a lot of things that are ongoing today that the U.S. military is doing on the ground to get over them. The use of the provincial reconstruction teams, which got off to a very slow start and had a checkered beginning, that has really picked up, and it's showing a great deal of improvement. In fact, our institute did work with one of their PRTs in pacifying the Triangle of Death last year, and it's held. But by and large, it's getting out of this mindset of being afraid to talk to the Iraqis. I mean, when you go to Baghdad and you look at the international zone, you feel like a mouse in a maze with all the concrete walls. That all needs to go away. You need to somehow expose yourself, and it's a risky proposition. It certainly, it doesn't happen without some form of risk. But until the Iraqis have more contact with the Americans, it's going to be a rough go.
Paul Hughes, Senior Program Officer at the U.S. Institute for Peace. Certainly, it will be a long-term proposition, getting the concrete to go away and intermingling with the people of Iraq. You know, the interesting thing that Hughes raises and in some of these other conversations comes up is we may be looking 5 years down the road at a situation in Iraq that looks completely stable and conceivably with the political sort of chemistry about Iraq being that maybe Bush was right. These negotiations are really, really critical.
I don't think anyone can say at the moment. There's just far too many variables, and then you have the world economy and the world politics changing. For example, we'll have a new president in the United States in January, and we'll see how that person, how he deals with what's going on in Iraq.
It's definitely a moving target. It's sort of interesting to listen to it. We've got all kinds of responses from you talking to about how distracted you are, how distracted you want to be, how distracted you would like never to be. 877-8-MY-TAKE, of course, is your way to connect with us. Speaking of distraction, one problem that I have is listening to The Takeaway. Its production seems to include lots of extraneous noises with nothing to do with the information in the stories. We're actually part of the problem. Why do we need these beeps and bloops everywhere, Dylan? That's a question for you. For that matter, some of the comments made by the presenters, this is for us, do not make much sense in the context. So the Takeaway is adding to the distraction problem. That's according to one of our listeners, Arlen, on
That's
our website.
What Arlen and Bobby, a doctor called, and I try to keep my cell on the vibrating mode 100% of the times, and I try to avoid taking calls when I'm in a conversation with a patient or a colleague unless there's a really important call that I have to take. I really excuse myself then and pick it up. But what I notice is a lot of people around me keep their phone on the non-dispatch mode or the, you know, musical tone or whatever. It rings, and it's distracting.
Dear Takeaway, generations after mine have no idea of the distractions that modern high tech has caused because they've never known a world of quiet, quality time. It all started with MTV. This emailer says, which caused the short attention span of their young audience. According to good sources, college professors, students don't know the meaning of simple words, etc.
All started with MTV.
Yeah. Actually, it all started with, like, what was Maggie saying? It all started with the Telegraph. Right? Yeah, there we go.
Today, we're also following what's happening in the market, where you have record $143 a barrel oil prices. And we're going to be taking a watch that and how that affects the market here in the U.S. as it opens shortly.
Yes, and the market had a big sell-off last week, down more than 3%, all three major indicators in the United States. So far, Asian markets did not respond to the sell-off, but we'll see. It's a long week, and it begins in half an hour on Wall Street.
And it's a short week because it's a holiday on Friday.
That's right. You can respond to anything on our show if you're not too distracted. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Don't forget our podcast. And remember, the 2008 Veep Stakes on our website. You can buy and sell and trade the possibility of who will be the vice presidential candidates for John McCain and Barack Obama.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.